Hey, what's going on, guys? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk right here on March 3rd. It's a Monday, March 3rd. Yes! How is everybody? Good? You have a good weekend? Finally got that rainstorm we were talking about. I was talking about on the Thursday bonus episode. I was clowning on the rain like, yeah, bitch, where you at, rain, bitch? And then it came. So funny. It's calling it like Stormocalypse. Stormpocalypse. Just a giant big deal about the rain. Stormpocalypse. There's like 7 million tweets on the rain, which is hilarious. That's how fucking LA is. Holy shit, it's raining. There's people that move here from all around the U.S. too, and they just laugh. You know, like, this ain't rain. It rained pretty fucking hard, though. It rained like 2 days straight, which sucks when you're me on the motorcycle. But there's our 2 days of rain. We'll be good for another 5 years. No rain. Jesus, man. Anyway, I'm doing the intro on a Sunday. Why the Academy Awards are going on. You're listening to the episode today on Monday, but I'm doing the intro right now on a Sunday, if that makes any sense. And the Academy Awards are going on. I'm not going to watch them this year, which I usually do watch them. I'm not the guy that's like, fuck the Academy Awards, that's dumb. I like them. I like to see the absurdity of it, and I also like to see artists win, people that win stuff that inspires me. You know, Wolf of Wall Street, that was a fantastic film this year. What else? 12 Years a Slave, I love that movie. Also, what else did I see this year? Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewellyn Davis, that was a great film. This was a great year for movies, which is not always the case. There was like a good drought of like 4 years of bad movies, and there'd be one good one, and that would win everything because it was only one good film out. Gravity, I like that. I don't think it's an Academy Award film. I think it was probably hard as shit to film, to be an actress in that one, which Sandra Bullock did. So she did a great job, and that was probably claustrophobic and bullshit shooting that movie. So that was great. I love Gravity. There was a lot of good films out this year. And like I said, I like the Academy Awards. I like watching. Sometimes they get it wrong. And when they get it wrong, they get it fucking really wrong. Like when they didn't give Mickey Rourke the best actor on The Wrestler a year. That's all politics. Don't let it fool you. Or the year they didn't give it for Sean Penn for Dead Man Walking. They gave it to Nicolas Cage for Leaving Las Vegas, which is a fine film, but it's not no Dead Man Walking. I didn't walk out of Leaving Las Vegas thinking, you know, like it wasn't mind changing or life changing. That Dead Man Walking, man, Sean Penn, you're like, well, where do I sit with the death penalty? That's heavy shit. So sometimes they get it wrong, and then they give that person an award later on, a makeup statue, and that always fucks it up. Some guy will be, you know, kick ass, and you go, oh, this guy's a no-brainer, but oh no, we forgot to give it to Sean Penn 4 years ago, so we're going to give it to him now for this lesser role because we owe him from last year. And then that fucking bites him in the ass because they start chasing themselves for years. What if the guy never does a film again, and that was his year, but he lost because somebody needed a makeup award? I know it's all jive and stuff, but that's real shit that goes on. But anyway, I love movies and I love the movie industry. I'm not a guy that shits on it. I don't believe in that. There's some stuff that comes out and it absolutely is inspiring. I know how much work it takes to make a film. I've done some movies, even on a small level, but you see all the hard work that goes into it, from the fucking drivers, the caterers, the grips, the directors, the writers, the set design, the clothing, all that shit, man. It's like, it's brutal work. brutal work, some of it, man. And these guys come to town and make magic. And you get to sit in your house and watch it now, you know? You don't even have to go to the theater anymore. You just click on the Netflix and watch shit. So, hats off to whoever wins. Whoever wins, man. This is a good year. There's a lot of good films, like I said. The only couple I didn't see, American Hustle, and I didn't see Dallas Buyers Club, which is weird. I want to see both of them. I'm just not in that frame of mind. I just come home. I work 7 nights a week. So I come home, I listen to my sets, I write, and then I audition or work on the podcast. So I'm just out of my mind. So when I do get to go to a movie, I'm pretty fired up. Anyway, enough of the movie talk. How are you guys? Happy March. March is here. Some great reviews last week from some of you Dell Razors. Let's see. Very good podcast by Mitch Robinson. Thank you, buddy. Very good. This is a very good podcast. That's his review. He shot down there. I love it. Mitch Robinson. Thanks, bud. Cali Kid, LA to San Francisco, 1965, wrote a great review. Love Dean's California attitude. Which is true. I love California, man. Everything on this podcast is probably inspired by California. You know? Just the great weather, the rock and roll, the motorcycle aspect, the movies, the beaches, the mountains. It's California. What a great state. I love you, California. If you've never been to California, come out and just explore. Don't be one of those people, I want to go to Europe. Nah, go to California. You're going to see so much shit in one state. You'll be good, man. One of my favorite podcasts, John 77. Thanks, buddy. Says his friend turned him on to it. And cool, man. That's how the podcast gets bigger. Old school rock and roll style. Word of mouth. Tell a friend, they tell a friend, they tell a friend. That's how you got to do it these days, man. If you're not on a big TV show or movies, you need the word of mouth from you guys. And I've been getting that. So thank you. Let me give you a couple things before I get into the episode. San Diego. March 14th and 15th, I will be headlining at the La Jolla Comedy Store. Get your tickets in advance. Come on, San Diego. Come out and see me. Two nights. I got some special guests coming down. I'll let you know about that later. But get your tickets. La Jolla Comedy Store, March 14th and 15th. San Francisco, I'm coming back at the end of the month. I'll be at Cobb's March 27, 28, 29. That'll be nice to be home. Hopefully, I'll somehow get to interview Dave Medichetti from Y&T and James Hetfield. I doubt it, but that's what my goals are. And then April 4th and 5th, I will be headlining at Pechanga Casino. Thanks, Perry, for that one. Pechanga Casino, April 4th and 5th. That's the shows for now. That's all I want to get into. Please come support. See us. Whoever I'm with, have some fun. We're going to, you know, be out there on the road. Also, thanks for your donations to the podcast. DeanDelRay@yahoo.com. If you want to do a donation, email me. DeanDelRay@yahoo.com. It greatly helps. Trying to get a new computer here. This shit is dying. Also, thanks to everybody that came to see me with Jay Moore. Jay Moore, what a fucking great guy. Another killer crowd at the Improv. I talked about it already, but Jay Moore and Barry Katz was there. Jay Moore's manager, and Barry Katz did a very cool shout-out to me on his podcast this week. You can find that on the Dean Del Rey, Del Razor's Facebook page, or on my Twitter, Dean Del Rey. Great guest today, San Francisco guy, Mickey Finn. Mickey Finn, lead singer of Jet Boy, one of those bands that did it. Moved from LA, from San Fran to LA, got a record deal on Elektra, And I'm not going to give away any of the story, but Mickey Finn, Jet Boy, had a song, Feel the Shake. Had a great record, Feel the Shake. And then did a record, Damnation. Some cool videos, Evil, look that up. I like that video a lot. And I've known this guy since 1983. Ran into him at the Comedy Store last Thursday night. He just happened to be there watching comedy. And boom, we refire up a friendship. Comes over, does the podcast. Just so cool to see him. He's a rider. He rides motorcycles. Harley Davidson. He's a great guy. He's a hard worker. I mean, he's worked all his life in the music biz, which is brutal. So it's great to have him on. All those guys are friends of mine from the old days. I did a little stint with him for a minute behind the microphone for about 5 minutes. You'll hear about that story right here. Mickey Finn, Jet Boy, what a great guy. Check him out. Before we go, Los Angeles Harley Davidson is sponsoring this episode. What a great place, Los Angeles Harley Davidson. If you ride motorcycles, Harley, you need any Harley Davidson stuff, call them up. Tell them, hey, I heard this ad on Let There Be Talk. I want to get the Delray discount. They're, let's see, 2635 West Orangethorpe Avenue, Fullerton, California. The website is Los Angeles Harley Davidson of Anaheim.com. And they've got a Twitter also, which you should follow if you are into motorcycles. Very cool stuff on Twitter. They post up bikes they're working on or deals they got going. They got a deal right now on rentals. You want to come out to LA and rent a bike and ride up to PCH or to Yosemite or to San Francisco, go in and get a rental from them. They're running some great deals on some baggers. Their Twitter is, my computer sucks, it's just fucking deadly pinwheel all the time, LA Harley Anaheim. Follow them on Twitter. Tell them Del Rey sent you. All right, I guess that's it. You got the shows. Keep emailing me and keep rocking. You guys have been fantastic. And I'll see you when I see you. Hopefully at one of the shows. Keep rocking. See ya. Here he is, Mickey Finn. Hey, what's happening? Another episode of Let There Be Talk. It's raining out. It's been raining 3 days. I've been clowning it like it's not going to rain, and it finally has been fucking storming. My guest today, Mickey Finn, former or still singer of Jet Boy.
Still again, singer. Again, actually, because I was replaced for a short minute.
Yeah. We'll get into that. But fucking, how long's that been?
Oh, man. 83 we started.
1983,
man.
Yeah. Now, if anybody doesn't know, I sang with him for like 2 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember if it was 1 day or 6 months or whatever. You know, it's such a blur.
Yeah, right.
But I remember I was in school. I would have to run to catch this bus. And if I missed the bus, I wasn't going to make it to rehearsal. And then I'd ride the bus all the way to Tiburon or San Rafael, transfer off a bus to Tiburon or wherever, where Billy Rose's parent mom lived. Yeah. And that's where they rehearsed. And after a while, I was like, I can't make it, man. But I remember early on, it was so long ago, but just hanging at the Stone every night with Billy and Fernie. We were fucking shyster kids, just egging people.
I mean, that's when the glory days of North Beach, the Broadway Strip, when it really was that way. It was just, you know, two blocks of, you know, or six blocks of strip clubs,
yeah,
nightclubs, punk rock clubs, glam rock clubs. Everything that was happening at that time was right in that little section.
Yeah, yeah.
Blue Hay Gardens, you know.
Exactly.
The CBGBs
Rock on Broadway.
Of San Francisco. Rock on Broadway. The
yeah, Blue Hay Gardens. Remember Nash?
Oh, you never play yeah. here again. Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, I saw some great shows there. Yeah. My point is, though, I hung out with Billy and Fernie all the time, but I never knew you, so where did you come from? I don't know what happened. I couldn't make it all of a sudden, and then you were the singer of the band. And yeah. I was like, oh shit, they got a singer. And but where were you, where did you live?
So that you know little thing played out like I was living in the South Bay, San Jose, Santa Clara, where I moved with my family from Jersey when I was about 15.
Yep.
Went to Santa Clara High, and you know, I got into the San Jose and South Bay punk rock scene, which led me to kind of the British metal and then eventually the glam rock scene. And, you know, I started out playing in some punk bands, you know, Reign of Terror and Executioner.
Down in San Jose?
Yeah, playing drums.
What,
and then,
oh, playing drums. Where were you yeah. playing? Like the Cactus Club and shit?
You know what? Those bands, I think we were just playing at people's houses and stuff.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then I got in my first band as a singer, which was called Sweet Evil. That was a San Jose, like very Sabbath, yeah. like Sabbath
Sweet
meets Motley
Evil.
Crue. Yeah, totally. And, you know, I met this girl, Sheila. She was like a, you know, San Francisco, like punk rock chick. And we, you know, we were hanging out in the city together. And then I met Billy and Fern. Actually, Sheila's girlfriend was dating Todd Crew at the time.
Okay.
The original bass player
right.
for Jet Boy. And me and Todd became friends. And so I was trying to bring Todd into Sweet Evil.
Yeah.
And at the time, he was also kind of just starting to play with Jet Boy. And he was like, no, you should join Jet Boy. So we kind of went back and forth with a couple rehearsals.
Right.
And Billy and Fern were always, you know, saying, yeah, you should come check out our band. Check out our band. And at the time, I was really like, you know, when I went to North Beach, it was like drugs and alcohol. And I was like,
yeah.
pass out in an alley somewhere almost.
That was it. You know, it was just fun. It. You're not thinking yeah. about any kind of thing yep, but yep. rock, you know, like fun.
Yeah, but they eventually got me out there. To
now,
the,
did you
know,
go to Fernie's parent, mom's
Billy's,
house?
Billy's,
or Billy, yeah.
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 I mean, it's cool. Like, we started in the garage. It was a garage, you know, with carpet on the walls and
Kiss
you know,
posters.
Exactly. And we banged out some, they banged out some songs and I banged out some lyrics and we just pretty much clicked right away and went with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember I kind of jammed with them a little bit and then, boom, they had a singer. I was like, oh, you know?
Yeah.
I remember one of the key things of when I jammed with him was Todd. He just seemed like he was way beyond years in his
yeah.
mind.
Oh, for sure.
Like, we were like sophomores or whatever in high school, but I remember we had to pick him up at like his mom's apartment or something mm-hmm. in Santa Fe, and he just came out all like, he was like way
yeah.
beyond.
Oh,
he was
sure.
like living the real shit.
Yeah.
And I remember specifically, he was the first guy I knew with a tattoo. He got a tattoo and he showed it to us at this party. It was that tiger or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it was fucking huge.
Yeah, I think he had either Bill Salmon or Henry Goldfield, I think, did.
Goldfield,
that.
Yeah.
Yep, Goldfield,
and the
yeah.
weirdest part about it was, this wasn't when everyone had tattoos. And I was like, mm-hmm. oh, fuck, this guy's like the real deal.
Yeah. I mean, he was, for how young he was. He
yeah,
was,
how old
you know,
was he?
I want to say that he was about 21.
Yeah.
I was already in Jet Boy. I was 20 when I joined. I turned 21 in that first year, I think. And but Todd was. He was the epitome of sleaze rock. You know, just every step that guy took
yeah.
was sleazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And just rock and roll. And also,
he looked dynamite,
this,
right?
He also was technically a genius. I mean, he had like a super high IQ.
Oh, really?
He got accepted to Berkeley.
Wow.
Before he even graduated high school, like he was like super smart.
Wow.
But he decided to go the route of, you know, having Keith Richards be his hero instead
yeah.
of Einstein or some shit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And he went that route.
So, yeah, he was older then because, like, when you're a sophomore in high school or a junior like I was at the time, even a guy like 21, I remember Hetfield. I would see Hetfield all the time, and they seemed like men.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. They were like drinking Jaeger and shit, yeah. And they were like, you're going like, oh, fuck, look at those. They just seemed older dudes, like Roadrunner.
Yeah.
You know, I had Alan on here and Lamont, Head On and all that. Yeah, they just seemed like older dudes, and we were like kids watching them trying to live our dream.
Yeah.
But I remember, man, like first tattoo. And I thought, like, well, that guy's playing Rock for Life. That's pretty fucking gangster, you know? And also, I remember, I think the next time we rehearsed, he never even showed up. We couldn't find him.
Right.
And we just jammed without him. I was like, I don't even think he even knew who I was. I was down there jamming, like one of those, like, oh, you the guy? All right. You know what I mean? So you guys get together and you get up going. And what's your first gig? Open for Head On?
You know, actually, our first gig was playing for, like, I don't know, I want to say it was Billy's high school prom or dance or something.
Yeah, Corte Madera High or something.
Yeah, it was, like, really, really quick after we just had, you know, 6 or 8 songs together. And then yeah, probably after that, you know, it was right into the MAB and the Stone and the On Broadway and stuff. You know, we just got on a roll real quick.
Yeah.
And
well, those guys were hard workers.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
they weren't fucking around. They had a vision.
You know, it was that perfect timing where, you know, I mean, the first glam revolution with, you know, T-Rex and the New York Dolls and all those bands, you know, and then I kind of like it came around a second time with like Hanoi Rocks, but it didn't hit America.
Nope.
You know, so when we started getting into that, we really exposed kids to something, and I think it was just a timing of they were ready for something new. You know, the punk rock scene had been booming there for a while.
Yeah.
You know, the metal scene and the rock scene was doing good, but
metal was huge. Yeah, I mean, we had Exodus.
We came out with the straight up like lingerie, like New York Dolls, you know, look, and people just went, "What is this?" And then we played like raunchy rock,
AC/DC kind of, style. Exactly. But yeah.
And, you know, people just ate it up, you know, so.
Now, what, when you first heard the tunes, what did you think of the tunes? Were you like, well, because you're coming from a punk atmosphere, and it was very AC/DC. Like, when I jammed with them, of course, they loved me because I loved AC/DC. Mm-hmm. But what were you thinking? Were you thinking like, ah, I don't know if this is going to work?
No, I wasn't. You know, my voice at the time, although I kind of got better at it because it was a goal of mine. My voice at the time was not AC/DC at all.
Nope.
I didn't have any edge or that. You know, I sang clean and kind of pretty and really poppy. And, I'm not afraid to say I've always loved pop music and
Cheap Trick, shit
exactly,
like that.
Poppy, catchy, you know, bubblegum stuff. So that was kind of my take on it. And you know, to this day, one of my favorite styles of writing is still to have somebody present me with a song and write the lyrics to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I also love to get involved in melodies, and there'd often be times when I would hum something to them, like, you know. And they would figure out the chords and play it. But initially, they had a handful of songs.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was hear them one time, and, you know, it was like my pencil was moving as fast as it can go. And we definitely busted out our first batch of songs really quickly. Little Teaser, In the Alley, Don't Touch My Hair, Sex. All those songs came, you know, early on. And I think that, you know, was one of the reasons why we just kind of seemed to come out of nowhere and boom, we were like, you know, doing it.
So. Absolutely. Now, I can't remember, but eventually, does Todd get fired or does he die first?
Yeah, no, Todd got let go. And, you know, I want to say, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Yeah.
I feel like things could have gone down differently. But at that time, I mean, I remember when our first serious manager, I mean, Jimmy Modern, you know, rest in peace, was the first guy to kind of help us along. But Bridget Wright came along and was our first serious manager.
And was she from L.A.?
She was from L.A. And we started making the trips down to L.A. And all of a sudden, everybody was like flashing these stars in front of our eyes. And I didn't really see it at first. You know, when they started saying, you guys are going to be as big as Van Halen and all this, I was like,
yeah.
Are you kidding me? I'm like dressing.
Well, we're talking about L.A. It's huge. Like,
yeah, right. Yeah. But I just didn't. I was just like, okay, whatever. Kind of along for the ride. And then you realize at a certain point how much you've let all these people infiltrate all the managers and lawyers and record label people. And, you know, it was like, I mean, So the guy that first signed us to Elektra, you know, he came to shows for like a year or so. You know, it was every little, no, you need to do this, you need to do that, be more like this.
Yeah.
Down to, I remember one time he didn't like my water bottle because it was like a motocross water bottle. And now I don't like that. It's not rock and roll looking.
Who was that?
Shit like that. Steve Prost.
Steve Prost. You signed to Elektra? We're jumping ahead. Elektra first and then MCA.
Yeah.
So you signed. Okay, so anyway, let's get to the talk.
So anyway. You know, it was at the time Todd was like on a peak of like, you know, you learn in retrospect that some people have a better tolerance than others at keeping their shit straight.
Yeah.
He did not.
Yeah.
He was one of those people that had he not died, he would have eventually had to go to rehab, get clean and sober before his life came back together. And we saw it. I saw it especially because I felt like I was the closest to him. He was my friend before, you know,
before the band
joined Jet Boy. And particularly he got in with like the Guns N' Roses guys and just a lot of Hollywood people at the time who were, you know, experimenting with heroin too much. And
it's pretty going interesting, too deep, right? You know? Like, I mean, there was some heroin going around in L.A. pretty hard. And some of the punk guys in San Fran. Mm-hmm. But to me, it seemed like an image. A lot of guys looked like they were on heroin.
Oh, definitely.
But with Todd, you knew he was really on it.
Yep.
But the scene I hung out was a lot of meth. You know, a lot of crystal.
That was there too. Cocaine,
speed,
a lot of coke.
Cocaine, coke, 80s, and booze.
It was all there. But you know what I think, you know, for me, I used needles. I did, you know, all that bad stuff. But I just knew when to like, you know, the next day and you come back to normal and you eat breakfast and, you know, you get into your week and you're going to rehearsal and doing your stuff and you're not thinking about getting high again. You know,
are you getting high with Todd at the time?
Yeah. I mean,
did he get you on it?
No. You know what? I heroin never clicked with me. I always just got really sick on it. It was like, I don't know. I also have a problem with, you know, certain opiate drugs to this day. You know?
Yeah.
They just make me really sick. And but I was really into coke. I used to slam coke.
Yeah.
And I used to do that with Todd and his girlfriend. And
that's
at one
wild.
Point they
now,
were dealing it. You know. So
let's talk about one thing here because I never used needles ever, but I've done all the drugs.
Yeah.
But it takes a different frame of mind shoot it, right? Because the drummer in my band was shooting drugs.
Yep.
I remember the first time I saw him shooting. I went in to get beer and I forgot my wallet. He decided to fix up before while I was in, not tell me. I came out and he's shooting up in the truck and I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
To me, it seems like just such a far distant. Like,
oh, it is.
Wow.
It is. And you know, I'll tell you this. There's two aspects to that. First, number one is you got to learn how to do it right.
Yeah.
And really, you need someone to show you.
Yeah.
Because if you hold it at the wrong angle, you're going to keep missing. You can get abscesses.
Yeah.
You know,
I've seen people with those weird old fucking welts and shit.
But the scariest thing, I mean, for me, like, I guess that was, I could consider that my downfall with using needles was when I learned how to do it myself.
Yeah.
Because initially, you get high with friends and you're like, hey, fix me kind of
that's
thing.
That's wild.
When you figure it out yourself, that's when you start, like, you know, it's a Tuesday night. And you're like, hey, I got a few extra bucks. I'm going to go get some and sit in my room and do it. And I did. I did that, you know. And for me, like, the cocaine was, like, my biggest vice. The heroin thing just never clicked with me. I always said that for these kids back then who were super into Johnny Thunders and Keith Richards and all these famous junkies that were really into the image
Burroughs.
Of it. But the ones who actually became heroin addicts.
Yep.
Like, they went out of their way to make that happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen easily. You got to work at it because you're going to do it. It's going to make you sick. There's like a long process of like building up your tolerance to it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, the first time you shoot up, you're sick.
Yeah, exactly. And even, you know, every time after that or if you do a little bit too much. But I'm saying to get to the point where you're like, oh, my God, I need it. Yeah. My body's burning. My skin's burning. I want to, you know, die. Like, to get that bad, you got to really work at it.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm like, man, you know, why would you work so hard at something that ultimately, you know, is so bad?
Yeah.
It's like trying to become a cigarette smoker in, like, you know, 2 weeks or something. It's like you got to smoke a lot of cigarettes to get to the point where you're like, oh, hell my God, yeah, I gotta have a cigarette. You know,
it takes a lot of work too. Yeah. Like, you gotta get fucking rigs and shit.
Yep.
Like, to me, it was like, fuck it, snort it, we're rolling. Let's get out of here. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And I mean, back then, we didn't have the HIV thing to worry about, the AIDS thing.
Yep.
And so, you know, we were sharing needles, everybody's sharing needles, and you're doing stuff
that's like amazing.
Boiling them. And,
yeah, right. That's amazing to get like Hep C or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially because we got a lot of tattoos too, you know?
Yep, and just, you know, trying to go into pharmacies, and oh, I'm a diabetic, I need one box of these.
Just
you know,
pulling that shit. Kind of,
exactly, you take like the cleanest cut looking guy and send him in there.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So eventually, you know, Todd's out of control.
You know, it got so bad to the point where it was interfering. Like when we were having important record company meetings or meeting with producers or things where it would be like, you know, just be sober for this meeting.
Yep.
You know, like do whatever you want afterwards, but just be there.
Just trick them.
Exactly.
We got to trick the company.
And nope. It was like, you know, I don't know. And it, I think for some bands that may work in your favor, not for us. The whole throwing up in the executive's office, running to the bathroom, carrying them, you know, that kind
of
thing.
Well, I always say that a lot of those stories that people read, like this guy shot up and was in there and the record company guy, those are fabricated.
Yeah, probably.
And GNR weren't junkies at first. You know what I mean? They had,
well, that was the thing about them, though. Because they weren't like Todd.
No.
Like, you'd saw them out, and they'd be sober, and they knew when and where.
They were working.
Exactly, you know? But Todd was the one that it was just like, he was, you know, I remember him falling over in rehearsal. Like, literally, you just hear the bong, and you look over, and the guy's, like, face first on the ground, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, this isn't even a meeting. This is like, you should want to be here and rock out and play our songs creative. That's the most fun part
Don't
about
be
it.
Sick here.
Yeah, exactly. So then it was like, yeah, we had the management and record label and all these people just saying, like, this guy's going to ruin your career before it even started. He doesn't have his shit together. You know, he looks cool. Like, everything's great, but you know, he's got to know whatever. We got him into rehab one time. We involved his family. We got him up to the Bay Area, got him into rehab. I think in about 2 days, he went AWOL and got a bus straight back to L.A., right back to the GNR house where he was staying at the time. We really tried to enlist those guys to help us reach him because he seemed closer to them at that time, and they were just really, really, to be brutally honest, had the kind of fuck you guys are pussies attitude or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And, you know, we just, I don't know, we just made that decision.
His mind, though, I think that's
in his mind was like, I've never fucked anything up. I've never fucked up a gig.
That's how how junkies are.
But
they don't see all the pieces you're picking up behind them.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Was he a songwriter?
He was a songwriter, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he had, you know, not as much. I'm not going to say as much, you know what I mean?
Right.
He could have been.
Yeah.
He could have been. I think we just, nobody got to see his greatness. You know?
Yeah,
he didn't, and nobody did.
Yeah.
He was a super cool bass player, and he was into looking cool, wearing his low slung bass and his whole slinky sleazy.
Oh yeah, he had the
movements.
Look.
Yeah, man.
He had the vest with the sleeves cut off, and the fucking tattoo.
You know, when you showed him something on the bass, he learned it instantly and remembered it. You know what I mean? He could have been great, but
at what point do you guys move to LA? You're like, we got to get the fuck out of here because you guys were one of the real bands that actually did it.
Yeah.
That's a scary thing when you're a fucking big. Like, you know, my band or other bands, you're kind of in this kick-ass scene in San Fran, and you know where the real shit's going on.
Yeah. I think when the negotiations started happening with our record deal was when the label said, okay, come on down, because you guys are going to be getting like a $50,000 advance as soon as we get this contract stuff worked out.
Yep.
And we'll get everybody set up, when, you know, get a couple band apartments and, you know, it'll be all good. But unfortunately, we came down and stayed in fucking crack hotel on Vine Street for like,
I remember
it. Oh, it's going to be a week.
I go by it all the time.
Be another week.
It's that one by the grocery store there, right?
It was so crazy.
I remember coming to see you guys, and there was like two rooms you had, I think, and there was that shit pool in the middle or whatever.
That place was so crazy. I could tell you so many crazy stories about that. Waking up to gunshots, waking up to like the helicopter with the spotlight right on top of the building.
Yeah.
A whole, you know, half the police force and like 20 black guys lined up in handcuffs.
Yeah.
Or Hispanic guy. Sorry not to, I'm not profiling. Oh, no, it literally was.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And just handcuffed on the ground, face down. And we're like looking out our window, like peeking out, afraid to even peek out the window.
Yeah. Well, and that's like, a different Hollywood. You know? Like, yeah. What people don't understand, this Hollywood now that people are at is a fucking shiny version of what we were rolling around in.
Yeah.
Because Hollywood was one street of good stuff, which was Sunset. You had the Roxy, Gazzari's, Rainbow, and then Viper Room later, and the Whiskey. That was all nice because it was all kids.
Yeah.
But when you had to go to like Cat House on another street or go up on to fucking the club, what's it on Hollywood Boulevard, that Raji's or whatever those were?
Yep.
Man.
No, you didn't really want to be in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard at night.
At all.
During the day, it was all tourists.
It was Day of the Zombies. At night,
it was just crackheads and homeless and straight up scary. That whole Boulevard street.
They had no street lights. That's where you went to buy crack, and it was gangster, man. And guaranteed something was stolen in your car if you left even four quarters in there, you know?
Yeah.
So you guys living in that hotel.
Yeah, and the contract just took forever. It was like another week and another week and another week. And, you know, we're waiting for the money and we're like living on government cheese and whatever.
Who's paying for those hotel rooms? Was it one or two? Am I crazy?
Yeah, I think it was like our management company or our attorney's office. Somebody was throwing up some money to keep us alive. But
hey, you guys fucking chicks in there bringing chicks back and stuff to this place?
Of course, man.
That's hilarious, right? Like, here's where we live.
And we were still dumb enough to go out and like try to buy weed on the street for people. I remember me and Billy one time, we got ripped off. It was raining. We found this black guy. He was like, yeah, I can get you some weed. Follow me. And we went on this, you know, down this street and up this street and up this street. And we're just like going, oh man, this is not smart, dude. That's how bad we wanted to get high.
Yeah.
So we get in front of this house and the guy's like, all right, you guys got to wait here. And we're like, nah. And it was like $20 or something. You
know? Yeah.
Give me your $20. And he was like, look, man, I'll take off my jacket. You can hold on to my jacket. And he literally had this like leather jacket. Gave it to us, went in the house. We're out there, like, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. What the fuck? What's going on, dude? We're getting ripped. I know it. Yeah. I know it. So we start looking at this jacket. It's all holy and moldy and moth poles and shit. Go up to the door, knock on the door. Some black lady answers the door and she's like, huh? Who? What? It's like, no, there ain't nobody came in. No, I don't know anybody. No, we don't sell the weed. Nothing.
Wow.
And we're like, the realization hits like, oh my God, we just got ripped off. And this lady instantly goes, well, hey, are you all look like you're musicians? We're like, yeah, we are. Like, well, hey, I got a bunch of gear. You want to look through it? I'll give you a good deal. So she whips out these crates of like mic cables and mics and like all this shit. We start digging through and we're finding all this shit. And we wound up giving her like another $25.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. You're buying weed. Next thing you know, you're buying stolen gear.
And we're walking down the street. We're like, man, they really got over on us. Cause you know, those two were working together. Uh-huh. He's like hiding in the back room.
Absolutely.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
They got our money. We got a couple used microphones.
That's fucking hilarious. Yeah. You guys start playing L.A. pretty hard. What are you playing? Yeah. Like Whiskey, Cat House, stuff
Whiskey,
like that?
Cat House, Club with No Name, The Scream.
Oh, yeah, The Scream?
The old downtown Scream, the underground one.
Yeah.
And it was cool because at that time, it was very cross-pollinated. We played with Jane's Addiction. We played with Guns N' Roses and Poison and Faster Pussycat and all those bands. But we also played with a lot of really different bands, too. Little Kings.
Oh, Little Kings. I forgot about them. Right? They were fucking great.
Cool fucking band, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the shows were always unique like that, especially Dale. You know, got to give a shout out to Dale Gloria for her shows, which were always eclectic. She had, you know, her clubs had a vibe that was a little punk, a little goth, a little glam, a little rock metal, like everything.
Yeah, she mixed it up.
Yeah. And she had a good lineup of bands that were all representing different genres, but still worked on the same bill together, you know?
You know, it's really weird that I think about back then is, we were in bands, but later on when I really became serious music, I played every night. But we would only play like once a month.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was an event. Yep. Isn't that so fucking weird?
It was. We printed flyers. We went out plastering flyers everywhere. We put ads in BAM magazine.
Yep.
And like we really did. We put a lot into it, man.
And then you would just play that one gig. It's funny, but we would rehearse six nights a week, man.
Yep.
And then flyer at night, meet chicks.
Yep.
And it was the same routine. Yep. It's funny. Just think how good we would have been if we played gig, like rehearsing every night. We did, and we got good. But if you play gigs, like when you go on tour and you come back, you're a monster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
And we did eventually, you know, we were fortunate enough to get on tour with Cheap Trick.
Yeah.
We did a long U.S. tour with Striper. We did a lot with Kix.
Yeah.
You know, shout out to Kix.
Fuck yeah, Midnight Dynamite.
Yeah. And Steve actually taught me a lot about, you know, vocal techniques and warm up exercises. And, you know, I never saw a more professional band than that band on tour. They, every night to them, regardless of the size of the club, was totally serious. They spent a long time in sound check and they sounded perfect every night.
That band was killer. Baltimore, Midnight Dynamite, and Blow My Fuse are masterpiece records.
Totally. Yep.
And the thing I really like about them was they had an AC/DC vibe, but they were a band that really had their own sound.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
Good harmonies and melodies. You know, definitely the Beatles influence in there in the songwriting. But definitely heavy and guitar heavy.
Yeah.
And just a killer singer, man. I mean, how
great, you know, singer if you're and a the rock bass metal player. Fan,
how could you complain about Steve Whitman? He's just, you know.
Oh yeah. Great. But what's that one ballad they had? It was Don't Close Your Eyes.
Yeah, totally.
It's so great. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now, once you guys are in LA, so you guys fire Todd, that's gotta be crazy, right?
Who fires him? You know? You know, I don't know. At that time, he was really distant from us.
Yeah.
I mean, we had two apartments. Our apartments were right at the top of La Brea and Franklin.
La Brea and Franklin.
Yep, right on the corner. They're still there.
Yeah.
And you know, we had our two apartments.
That's right here by my house.
Yeah, we had our two apartments right there. But he was always, you know, it was kind of like he jumped ship a little bit. He was just like all about the Guns N' Roses guys and just hanging there and staying there and partying there all the time. And so, you know, I don't remember, you know, having a serious conversation with him about it. I mean, I know he was really bummed, you know, he was crushed and he instantly went on a downward spiral, which is, you know, kind of what we were trying to avoid all along.
But that's what people need, right? Yeah. Hoping they don't die. Right. They need to hit rock bottom. Yeah. And then I always tell people that I have friends now, they're floating around. You see them and people go, oh, man, they're fucked up. And you go, that's because people keep picking them up.
Yeah. Exactly.
You can only pick someone up so many times and you put them in rehab or whatever. Yep. And back then we weren't even doing rehab. But you go, look, dude, we're going to fire you from this band if you don't get your shit together. Yep. And they keep going down the path to getting high. And then they need to hit rock bottom. And then they go, fuck
it. And that was where it was like, you know, when we got him into rehab and he was hearing us, you know, and it was like, come on, we want to help you. We involved his family. And then when he bailed rehab and went straight back to the Guns N' Roses house, it was like, you know, that's where we were really like, come on, like, you guys got to help us.
Yeah.
Like, he's not listening to us, but he looks up to you guys. He wants to be with you guys.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not hating on any of those guys. You know, I haven't been in communication with most of them. You know, I've talked to Duff a couple times, you know, here and there, but I'm not hating on those guys. I'm sure we all would do things differently. You know, you learn as you grow. But you know, I just think they didn't really see it, and they were riding their wave.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
it was like, this guy's our bro. He can hang out with us whenever he wants. Yeah. But then when it happened, and we kicked him out of the band, I'm sure he looked at those guys as like, you know, what am I going to do now? And what can you tell him? Like,
you're our roadie.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, we got a bass player. Yeah, you know,
I mean, what are they going to do? Now, you know,
just roll around.
How can we help you? You can party with us anytime you want, dude. You're always welcome at our house, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but now I'm not one of you anymore.
It's kind of weird, right? Because they're doing business.
Yeah, exactly.
They're doing band business. And now he's not in a band.
Next thing you know, he like grew a big grizzly beard, which in the glam rock days was not as cool as it is today.
No way.
Grizzly beard. Every time you saw him, he just was just greasy and sweaty and like fucked up, and he really just didn't care.
Were you seeing him around still?
Yeah.
That's weird. And he just went Morrison style,
Just went fully, like, you saw him, he was just hair in his face, wouldn't look you in the eye, just fucked up, you know? And
Sometimes when you run into guys like that, they constantly do this too. Like, it's probably the best, man. I got some shit going on, and
yeah.
But when you see a giant beard and shit, you go, not during that era.
And I mean, that's really kind of the end of the story right there. You know, we got contacted. Our number one choice was Sammy Hoffa from Hanoi Rocks.
Insane.
And we got him in the band, and we went and we recorded our record. And a month later, we were in Miami mixing the record at Criteria Studios down there. And we got word that Todd had died. And, you know.
Where was that? In New York?
It was in New York, as far as I know. You know, the story I got, he was with Slash and Lois Ayers, a porn star chick who was friends that was hanging around at that time. And, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to even talk too much more detail about that. But it's
just, I get it.
It was like not a shock, but it was like totally heartbreaking at the same time. And, you know, I mean, I miss the guy to this day. You know, it is one of those things that stays with you for the rest of your life. And, you know, there's a big feud started between Guns N' Roses and us, and they really started trying to point the finger, and it's your guy's fault, and you fucked him over. He was your bro, and blah, blah, blah. And,
I mean, you know, it's just partying. Yeah, nobody's to blame.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody's to blame, man, because here's the thing. If somebody tried to get me not to party back then, there was no fucking way.
Right.
Because that's part of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And now when you look at it, it's such a business thing. Mm-hmm. You know, a stylist comes in, they grab four clowns, they go put these wallet chains on, and you got to have the proper facial hair, and here you go, you got a banjo, and now you're playing rock. But back then, if somebody truly told me that I can't party anymore, I was mowing them over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just, and also, I enjoyed the darkness of drifting out into fucking San Francisco streets. Yeah.
And there's no doubt, like some of the best music and art in the world is created with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And some of my best performances live on stage, definitely.
Yeah.
I was lit up and I was having fun, and the crowd could tell this guy is having the time of his life, and he's kind of wasted, which keeps you on the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
Is he gonna fall off the stage? Is he gonna like do something crazy, you know?
But the point is, we get it.
Yeah.
We never fucking lost the original. The steering wheel was always pointed towards forward of rock and roll. And we've seen it many times, man. I mean, great product comes out from these guys, but then they're gone. Sea Hags was an incredible band.
I know.
And look at that. Yeah. Dusted by drugs. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I saw Ron Yoakam.
Yeah.
This was maybe, I don't know, in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Jet Boy did the Hate Street Fair.
Right.
And I saw him that day.
You did?
And we hung. And,
what'd he look like? I heard he sells shoes now or something.
You know, I mean, he was always a little spacey kind of guy, I guess. You know, he was cool. You know, we talked, and he had his wife or girlfriend. They had like a music project together, and we took this trippy picture together. We took one picture together, and somehow there's like this beaming sunlight.
Yeah,
from the ghost us that it just really looks like angelic in some way. And
yeah,
like me and Ron, I was just like, wow, that is like the craziest looking.
It's like a drug ghost, right? Totally. Floating around.
It's just like, you know, it's almost like he has a big halo over his head with like sunbeams beaming out and stuff. I was just like, damn, Saint Ron. You know?
Yeah. So here's a crazy story. You guys get the deal or whatever. You're getting fucking big.
Mm-hmm.
You get Day on the Green.
Yeah.
Now, to me, the Day on the Greens are pretty iconic. If you look around my house, I worship Day on the Greens. Yep. They're the reason probably I love music.
Sure, for Bay Area kids.
Bay Area kids, man. No, it's like summer camp.
Yep.
Mom dropped you off, or you rode the BART station. You got off right there at fucking Fruitvale or whatever it is and walked across the thing and went in and saw some of the best shows ever.
Yep.
One of the iconic ones, of course, was with Metallica with Cliff Burton. That to me was the changing of the guard. Like, these guys have made it.
Yep.
And I was standing there freaking out watching them play.
Yep.
But you guys played one. It was Whitesnake was the headliner, right?
Mm-hmm. Whitesnake,
Poison was on it.
Yep.
Motley Crue?
Yep, Motley
Crue. Girls, Motley Crue, Poison.
Actually, I think Motley Crue headlined.
Headline, yeah. And Whitesnake. Right.
And then Poison. And that's then it. Us opening.
That's it.
Yeah.
I remember taking a fucking dose of some killer mushrooms. It's true. And they were fucking coming on. pretty strong. I was sitting down. All right, Jet Boy's going to come on. You guys come on. I'm like, fuck, these things are way too strong. And I look and there's no Billy up there. Yeah. And I have no idea. And I go, hey, man, they're missing a guy. And I'm fucking, I'm high on shrooms. And I'm like, what's going on? And not till I think mid-set or something, I find out you guys, your van crashes on the way up there.
Yeah. Well, you must have been high. Or you missed the intro, because actually Bill Graham came out on stage and introduced us. And he actually, it was one of those Day on the Greens, which was common, where it was so hot and the people up front were getting crushed and they were pulling people out that were passing out and trying to spray water. So they literally were like, hey, if you guys don't mind, we're going to put you on 15 minutes early because the crowd is just, you know, we need to get this going.
Yeah, they're radical.
And Bill Graham came out and he did announce that we got in a car accident on the way up, and that one of our guitar players was in the, he was like, he's in Cedar Sinai Hospital right now.
Whoa.
Let's give him a big, you know, let him hear
back
you.
Here in LA.
No, he was up there.
Cedar Sinai. Oh, gotcha.
He's up there, and they're like, let him hear you in the hospital. Give it up for Jet Boy. And it was cool because there was people up front that had our like our little like homemade t-shirts that we like spray painted with a stencil and stuff like that. People were holding him up in the crowd. So
that's a fucking huge show to be on.
It is. And
I'm talking 65,000 in the A's baseball field.
Yeah, we had no sound check.
Yeah.
And we had no Billy.
Yeah.
And when we set foot on that stage, it was freaking terrifying because that stage to me was like the size of a football field. Like
it is a giant football field.
Like it was literally giant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
now what happens? You guys are coming up in the van the night before?
No, we had rented a car. I think I think Fern and Ron had driven up separately, and it was me and Billy and Sammy.
Mm-hmm.
And we rented a car, like a, I don't know, like a Lincoln or something. It was a big four-door with a big trunk so we could put lots of gear in it.
Yeah.
And Billy was driving. I was asleep in the back seat. Billy and Sammy were up front. And, you know, yeah, we got, it was a couple old guys.
Like, you're on I-5.
We're on I-5.
In the middle of the night?
A route that we've made a million times. No, middle of the day.
Middle of the day. Daylight. Gotcha.
All of a sudden, this car comes across the divider.
Whoa.
And they had fell asleep at the wheel.
Wow.
So they just came across the divider, fucking hit us head on.
Whoa.
And, and then there was also like a truck and another car behind us.
Now you're sleeping, right?
I'm sleeping, yeah. I just woke up with blood all over my face from the rear window smashing inward.
Yeah.
And, you know,
do you guys roll or what?
No, we didn't roll. We spun.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of like,
oh, like a boom, like a side of a thing, yeah.
Yeah, so they spun, we spun. It was two old guys, like, in their 70s who had gone fishing, and they were on their way back, and they just fell asleep at the wheel. And those guys got pretty messed up. They helicopter lifted them out. We got a two-hour ambulance ride to the nearest hospital.
Yeah.
And,
is your gear fucked up in the back?
The gear didn't get fucked up, but Billy's arm looked like the letter Z.
Whoa.
Literally.
Now,
like, it snapped in half.
And there's like bones out?
No, it wasn't. There wasn't bones hanging out, but the skin was like his arm broke in half completely. Wow.
And it's weird because you're thinking about Cliff Burton had played it a couple years before and he was gone from a bus crash.
Yep.
And these are like Bay Area guys and you're going, fuck,
Yeah, it was crazy. Just, you know, that whole realization of like waking up from a car accident, I'm bleeding, my head's pounding. You know, people are like, lay down and don't move and, you know, all this. And, you know, Billy's holding his arm and going like, I think it's going to be okay. Yeah, I think it's going to be okay. It might be broken. I don't know. And I'm looking at his arm going like, you don't want to go like, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. That thing's fucked.
I can picture it to this day. It was like the letter Z just broken and like twisted. And, so Billy was in the hospital for... I mean, he underwent surgery. They put metal plates and screws in his arm. Yeah. And like,
at what point does he say, go play the gig?
I don't think he did. I think it was probably like our management saying like, you know, you guys can do this. You know, you'll get sympathy from the crowd anyway. And I guess, you know, we were probably hoping to get a sound check, which we didn't get.
Wow.
And with two guitar players in any band, if you have
one guy's playing
one part, one's playing another part. So there was a lot of sloppy things that happened where, you know, it would be like the song, there would be like a break and Billy would play a riff and then it'd be like silent. He'd be trying to remember Billy's part. So there was definitely some craziness there. But I remember, you know, super cool, like looking over and Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx were on the side of the stage watching our whole set.
Yeah.
My family came to that show. My mom and dad were backstage, and Bill Graham knows how to throw a party. So the backstage,
oh god, it's
like,
great, right?
You know, each band has their own air conditioned trailer. There's great food,
booze,
like great
and
buffet,
food.
Booze. And I remember being in the trailer and looking out the window, and here's my mom and dad sitting at a table with Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee, and I hadn't even met them yet.
That's great.
So I'm looking out, and I'm like, shit. I'm going to go have my parents introduce me to Tommy and Nikki.
Yeah, how great is that? Because you know, at the time,
yeah, you're
a kid.
You're
fucking,
not going to walk up to them and be like, hey,
the
how's it going, guys? I wanted to meet you.
Yeah.
You're too shy. You're too scared to do that. So I'm like, this is perfect. I'll go say, hey, so I did. I went out. I'm like, hey, mom and dad, how you doing? Yeah. And they sat down and, you know, then we met. And it was like that kind of thing. Super cool. I mean, for that show, Whitesnake.
Yeah.
You know,
huge.
Tommy Aldridge.
Still of the night.
Oh, there goes
Eric.
Tommy Aldridge. There goes David Coverdale. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, they had John Sykes.
Yep.
Fucking Thin Lizzy, man, and then Poison, you know.
Yeah, so you know, and of course, you know, we were all shaken up from the whole thing, and it happened so fast.
It's fucking
about
wild,
Billy,
right?
Like, you know, we went and visited him in the hospital, like either after the show or the next day, and we took some pictures together, and you know, he got tons of fan mail at the time, which was cool.
Yeah.
So, and that guy was back playing shows with a cast still on.
Yeah.
So I remember him putting on finger picks
because
he couldn't strum with the cast on, but we literally played shows with him with that cast on still, and it was quite a rehabilitation process for him. But
he's a street gangster.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I like about Billy?
He's a skateboarder, you know what I mean? Skateboarders are tough.
Well, you know what I like about him is he came from fucking a rich neighborhood. I don't know where you grew up, but I grew up no fucking money. And I'm not saying he was rich or whatever, but Tiburon, the area that he lived in.
Yeah, I mean, they were renting that house, so his parents didn't really have money, but
yeah,
I know. That was a nice place.
That was a nice place and a nice neighborhood and everything.
Yep.
Somebody could have easily just backed out quick of like, this ain't for me now. I had a little fun and rock and roll. But that guy is a lifer like you or I, you know, just loves it.
Yeah, that's one of the things I remember meeting Billy and Fernie was that for me, I loved music, but I was just like your average, like I love music and bands or whatever.
Yeah.
Billy and Fernie were like walking encyclopedias
mm-hmm.
of like I didn't even know what a producer was. What's an engineer? What's a producer?
Oh yeah.
They knew every guy that who produced what record, who was the second engineer, who was this and that.
Yeah.
So they knew everything about music and the music industry. To me, when I met him, I was just like, I'm not at that level.
Well, they got it mapped out.
Yeah.
They're ready, man. Yep. What a perfect band to sing in because they've already got the vision. We're going to look like this. We're going to sound like this.
Yeah.
We're going to have this guy do our record, and we want to be on this label or whatever.
Yeah.
They knew what the fuck they were doing.
Yeah.
And you get the right guys in a fucking group, man, you're going to make it.
Yeah.
I don't care what anybody says. A lot of bands didn't make it. That's because if you looked at it and the inside, the nucleus of the band, there's always two shitty dudes.
Mm-hmm.
One guy,
right.
Well, this guy actually worked construction and was never really at rehearsal, and this guy had a fucked girlfriend. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
every time.
My friend, Monster Matt Montaldo, said it best. He's like, you don't want to be a butt band. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you don't want to be one of those bands where people say, yeah, they're great, but that one dude, you know, they're really good, but the guitar player sucks. Oh, they're really good, but that one guy looks like
It's always because it's hard to find.
I know it is.
Four or five fucking guys on the same page.
Trust me, I'm challenged because I have a new band for the last 4 years, Cold Blue Rebels. And, you know, in 4 years, you know, we lost a drummer. We got another drummer. We lost a guitar player. Got another guitar player.
Yeah.
And so it's like still, man, it's like, you know, it's
especially
things
when
don't
you're
change.
At this age.
I know, right? Yeah.
When you get to a certain age, the guy's like, bro, I can't go across country in a van. I got two kids, man, and this job where I'm making 40 grand now
exactly,
a year.
Right,
You know what I mean? Like, hey, when you weigh 40 grand a year in front of some guy, man, do they jump.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just gotten harder to be,
God.
Especially in a new band, it's harder.
Yeah.
You know, because
it's easier one way of letting people see you, but it's harder to get people out to see you.
Gas prices and everything, it's so expensive to go out there and do a tour. Like, people don't understand.
Yeah.
At a small theater and club level, there's no money to be made.
Zero.
Because if you're the headliner, you've got more people working for you.
Yeah.
So there goes your profit.
Yep.
If you're an opening band, like what we did, the full punk rock tours, where it was like the four of us.
Yeah.
And we sold our own merch, and we set up our own gear, and humped everything, and it was just drove
and
ourselves.
Fucking guys in their 40s.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
And you make no money. You go out for 6 weeks.
Yep.
It pays for itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
But now you're
but
behind
now
the
now
eight
I'm
ball.
Like, I could have stayed home and, you know, worked and made money to pay my bills. And on the other hand, now I get home and I've got all these bills due and I'm like, shit, what am I? I got to scramble to get some money quick to pay this stuff.
Yeah.
But everybody had a good time and they came to the shows and they supported and we signed a million autographs and, you know,
whatever. Shit,
so they think like, you know,
you think it's going, you know, but it's gone
they think,
already.
Yeah, they literally think we're living the dream. Like, oh my God, I would do anything to do what you do. And it's like,
yeah.
Don't say that so fast until you do it, man. Yeah. You know, you're what was 6 weeks. Your body's aching. You're
oh god, you and you're fighting. You're done with the dudes in the band. Like, I'm done with you fuckers. You're
fighting each other and shit. Yeah.
What was the decision for the Mohawk?
You know, I mean, because I was a punk rocker.
Yeah.
And I had Mohawks, you know, before I joined Jet Boy. And, yep. I, and I like that. They say you can, you know, you can take the punk out of the scene, but you can't take the scene out of the punk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I retained that. And it was always part of me. And I just went for it. I think Sheila at the time was going to like beauty school.
Yeah.
So she was super into dyeing my hair and cutting my hair and stuff. And we just kind of did it on the spur of the moment. And
that thing
and
was giant, yeah, like GBH album cover style.
That's how I got the nickname Mickey Finn, because in the punk rock scene, I had this fin that was kind of similar to the psychobilly style mohawk,
yeah,
where it was shaved all around, and I just had this fin on the top of my head. So they started calling me Mike Finn.
Yeah.
And then, when I started in Jet Boy, you know, I was like, yeah, Mickey Finn, you know, because nobody used their real name back then.
No,
you know?
No, hell no. Yeah, fuck no.
But yeah, the mohawk, then it became my trademark, and, you know, there's been times I kind of have regretted that to a point because you get bored of it and you want to change it, but then you're like, oh man, no one will recognize me.
Right. That thing's got to be weird to sleep with, because back then you were using like Aquanet other stuff that came out. It was like Spritz or whatever.
Nah, I was straight up Aquanet.
Like, that thing would be just rock hard, right?
Yeah. You're like, luckily, I don't sleep on my back.
That'd be
perfect
funny.
For sleeping on the side.
That'd be funny if like fucking a chick, you just poke her in the eye with your fucking hair. Right?
I'm sure it happened.
Yeah. So now you guys signed to Elektra, but your record never comes out with Elektra, right?
Right. Yeah,
Explain to people what's going on with that.
Yeah, this is something you learn too, that you learn is not unique, and it happens all the time, especially with big conglomerate companies. So Elektra was an East Coast label, and they had West Coast offices. So the West Coast offices had a president and their A&R staff, and it was, you know, not a huge label, but it was a lot of offices and quite a lot of people working there. And I guess things had been going badly and unbeknownst to us.
Yeah.
So our not only was our record done and ready to go, it was literally about, I want to say, a week or weeks before the release date.
Right.
And suddenly we get the news that Elektra just cleaned house and they fired the president and everyone down the line, including our A&R person, and they're going to shelf your record.
Wow.
They're not going to follow through with putting it out.
Yeah.
And I think
which is a cancer what people they listen to the show. If you get dropped or whatever in the 80s, that was it for you.
Yeah.
You were not coming back.
And you know, it's like, to me it's the stupidest thing, because you think like, well, they just spent, you know, $250,000 on this record and now they're not even going to try to put it out.
Who produced it?
But yeah, it was Tom Allen. Tom Allen.
Tom Allen did Motley Crue, big one.
He did Judas Priest, he did the first Black Sabbath album. Yeah, Loverboy. He was a big producer, did a lot of stuff.
Now, Elektra had Metallica, Motley Crue, and you guys,
and they also had Island Records, and they had a big catalog, but you know, you got to remember that you got accountants looking at it going like, hey, these West Coast offices are costing us money, they're not producing, so let's just get rid of everybody there and restaff it and start again. They're not going to look at these projects and say, well, this Jet Boy one, they're all over the magazines. These guys are really pegged to be big.
Yeah.
Because then they got to spend money and time to analyze all that data, which they don't want to do. They want to stop spending money.
That's stupid,
right?
And
they don't want to spend any more money to promote it, or don't want to take any chances. We don't trust these guys anymore. They haven't produced shit for us. Let's let them go. And they just let them all go.
Before you signed with Elektra, do you remember the other labels that were coming around? Did you have a lot of labels?
Yeah.
Like a bidding war?
Yeah, it was. There was interest, but you know, there was ones that kind of came to a couple shows, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, we're thinking about it kind of thing. And there were the ones that were like, yeah, we're really into this. You know, we're going to keep coming to shows and follow them a little bit more.
What made you choose Elektra? Was the guy just the dude?
They ultimately, they... they were the most interested, the most passionate about it.
Yep.
And then it comes down to, you know, contracts that, you know, they were just offering the best deal, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But really, I think it was the passion of Steve Pross and the passion of that label, yeah, you know, to work with us.
I feel...
And maybe they had Metallica, too. That was yeah. One for us, you know?
I feel when you pick the whoever... This is what I feel and a gut feeling. Whoever comes first and goes, I fucking get it. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody comes to me right now and wants to manage me and says, I get it. That's the guy I'm going with. Because the other guys, it's easy to come around once they're success.
Yep.
That's easy.
Yeah.
But when you get a guy that goes, I get what you're fucking doing. Exactly. That's the guy you want to go with because he's the guy that nonstop behind closed doors goes, no, man, this is the band. Instead of, you guys might be right, saving his ass. Mm-hmm. He goes, no, I love this band. They got they got Feel the Shake. They got tunes, you know?
Yep.
So they drop you, and now what are you guys like?
So yeah, now we're like, you know, this is where our first downfall starts, really, because, you know, now we no matter what happens, we're going to lose momentum.
Yeah.
So, you know, the management, everybody's telling us, you know, don't worry about it. You guys will get picked up in an instant, but it's in record company time, an instant is a year. Because the whole negotiation of contracts takes forever.
Yep.
Because these lawyers get going back and forth. So yeah.
Anybody shows interest, now Elektra all of a sudden is going to jack the money up.
Yeah, they did. And so there was a couple labels that got interested. Warner Brothers and MCA, obviously, was the one that really stepped up. But you know, of course, MCA was like, well, we want to sign the band, but we want to put him in the studio to record another record.
Yeah.
Obviously, they didn't want to buy that record from Elektra.
Yeah.
But we're like, you know, that's so retarded. I mean, we just, this is our first album.
Yeah.
A band only gets one first record.
Yeah.
If you want us to have us start all over and write new songs, then we're going to get in the studio a year from now and we're going to be different.
Yeah.
You know, you got to capture the entity of this first record. So we were like,
and that record was done a year ago already.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're like, nope, absolutely not. If you want us, we got to put out this record, which they did.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was not in our best interest because I don't think they really got behind it.
Yeah, they didn't care about that record.
Yeah, it was, I think, you know, 3 months or 4 months. We went out and did, you know, a bunch of touring, and then they said, okay, they want to pull you off the road, and, you know, we wanted to continue.
Yeah.
You know, we had tours lined up, and we had stuff going on, but they were like, no, they want you to, you know,
come. What was the first tour you went on when the record was out?
I want to say Striper.
Striper.
Yeah, Striper. What was that like? And then Cheap Trick. It was phony, you know. Those guys, their whole thing was phony.
Yeah.
You
mean they weren't God guys?
They weren't God guys.
That's hilarious.
They were walking around backstage with beers in their hand.
And chicks.
And chicks, totally. And then it was like the next week they'd have their wives on the road and they'd be pushing baby strollers around. And I don't think the crowd bought it either because almost every night they threw these little Bibles
into
the crowd. And all you saw was pages flying in the air like confetti. So I'm just like, this is the Striper crowd and they're just tearing up the Bible and throwing it in the air. Like, I don't think so. I think people just really dug their music.
I think it was a gimmick. Isn't that weird? Because like to me, once I found out they were a Jesus band, I was not going to listen to them at all.
Exactly.
I don't care how good the song is.
Exactly.
It's like, hey, you're trying to push religion.
And I think that's why they did when we were on tour with them.
Yeah.
They tried to act all tough, like any opportunity, you know, because they were just like, they didn't want that squeaky image, really.
Yeah.
I think they had a good idea, and I think they
tapped
into
the
market. But I think eventually they wound up building more metal fans and less Christian rock fans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was just like,
yep,
okay, well, I don't know if that really worked or not. We probably could have made it on our own without bringing in the Jesus.
Like Creed
thing, you know?
Was Jesus.
Yeah.
But they kept that way under because, you know.
Exactly.
So now you come off the road and you guys do Damnation. And who produced that one?
That was Dwayne Barron and John Purdell.
And what did they do? Like Tesla or something?
They did it. They were a young production team, and I think they worked with Motley Crue and a bunch of bands. I don't know. Once again, I'm not the encyclopedia guy. Ask Billy Rowe anytime. He'll tell you
every
detail.
Yeah.
But those guys were super talented. And another thing about that record, which was interesting, was it was the very beginning of that kind of digital era. In other words, they were doing a lot. They were using I don't know if they were using Pro Tools. No, but something back like then, that a yeah. lot.
Well, remember so, ADATs were out?
Yeah, yeah.
People recorded yeah, this digital was, ADATs.
Yeah, they came and went really fast.
Yeah.
This was like the difference for me between this record was and it was like I was doing three takes of each line of each song.
And they then just
we
would go
and sit down and they would, you know, digitally
comp them. Yeah.
So we would listen each line, pick out the best sounding one, boom, put it in.
Yeah.
Go to the next line, listen to all three versions. And I was like, wow, this is so cool because.
Well, yeah, it was easier to sing because.
Yeah, because you're doing it in little pieces.
You just fly three takes and then get the ultimate vocal.
Yep,
you comp the vocal. Whereas before, you'd have to go in and one wrong move, you try to punch it in or re-sing the whole thing.
Or they're cutting tape with the razor blade and splicing it together.
And also, you never get the character right. So you'd be like, feel the shake.
Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, if I was flowing or if there was a phrasing that needed to happen, we went with it, but we did have that tool of each time because that kind of stuff was going on, but the difference was there was be a guy like, okay, splice these two together.
Yeah.
And they would literally
take an hour
to the splicer and splice it, you know. So this was like boom, they were digitally doing it with computer. So it was pretty cool. Great experience.
Where'd you record that, in LA?
Yeah, we did it at I want to say Music Factory.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right over here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good studio. And
then what happens? You do the Evil video.
Yep.
That thing had some money in it, right?
Evil video got turned down for daytime rotation by the people at MTV who specifically said the singer is too scary for daytime rotation. Exact words.
Oh, hold on. I got a pit. Yeah, so too scary for the MTV day rotation.
Yeah, it was weird because it was our second video, which was getting pretty heavy rotation in Headbangers Ball.
Yeah,
which was the late night.
The first one was Feel the Shake video.
Yeah, Feel the Shake. That was
other videos from that, right?
Nope, no other videos from that. And then the next one was the Evil video, which was kind of our
great
mid-tempo
song.
It is. It's a very infectious mid-tempo song.
Did you write
song.
That? Or did they have a? Did you guys have a writer?
We did have a co-writer for that, really minorly. I want to say it's the same guy. We did a little co-writing with him. He co-wrote that song, "The Flame," with Cheap Trick.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know. Right? That's a great song. Yeah.
But it was real minimal.
Yeah,
really, really minimal. His involvement, like a couple little lyrical things and a couple little parts. Yeah. You know.
Yep. Now the video had a lot of reptiles. Were those yours?
We had a snake in there. No, we didn't use ours. Although, as you know, I've been a reptile freak for years.
But, yeah,
those were rented. As the girl in the video also was rented. but it's funny too because at the end of the video, there's a girl, a half naked girl or mostly naked girl with a snake climbing on her, and then a spider crawls across her face at the very end. But they didn't say it was because of that. They said specifically the singer with the mohawk is too scary, which is really absurd.
Yeah, that's funny because
he was ahead of his time, but it's like, it really wasn't anything that extreme. It was just different.
Yeah.
Because I looked like in the opening scenes with the studded jacket, I looked like GBH.
Yeah.
But then I was playing, radio friendly rock songs.
And
so.
A great jacket. You got any of those clothes left anymore?
Very few.
I know, right?
I do still have some custom leather pants from our first tours, but nothing really that I made myself. I have my old Jetboy vest.
Yeah. Oh, the original
patched
one?
Up original one, yep. Never been washed. My studded jackets, I wound up selling all that stuff when I needed money over the years.
yeah, man. Now, when Damnation comes out, you guys go on the road?
Yeah, we go on the road with Cheap Trick.
That's got to be wild, right?
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, touring with some of your rock heroes, and they're super cool to us every day from day one. They're totally big brothering us. I mean, to the point where they're telling their road manager to fuck off when they wanted us to be up on the stage during their set.
Yeah.
And they're trying to tell us we can't stay there. And then Rick Nielsen is like going, hey, fuck you. I told them they could stand here. Get the fuck,
Yeah, yeah.
And we're like, oh, yeah, Uncle Rick.
right?
Eating, dinner with them every day, hanging out on the bus, just shooting the shit. Those guys couldn't have been cooler, better experience, best experience of any famous rock stars I've ever met.
Wow. And so then when does it go bad? Damnation doesn't sell?
Yeah, no, it's not that at all. It's not that at all. Unfortunately, it's politics again.
Oh,
shit. So we're on the road with Cheap Trick, and we've got like two or three more tours. I think we were supposed to maybe tour with Extreme. There was like some good stuff lined up. And so what happened was Sony Music came along and bought MCA.
Oh, yeah. The old swallow up.
Exactly. And it was like that. Like, they, we got a phone call one day. You guys got it, you know, after this tour, you're coming back. You're not going on to the next tour. Your tour support's been canceled.
Wow.
You
know,
and that was all they told us. And we're like, what the hell? What the hell? So we get back. Literally, like, the next day, we have a meeting at the record company. We show at the record company, and MCA at that point was a huge establishment.
Yeah.
And there was, like, you know, offices and floors, and I want to say maybe 100 offices or something, you know?
Right.
We walk in the building, and it's just deserted.
Whoa.
Like, on a weekday, it's just deserted. You're used to walking through, like, hey, Marianne. Oh, hey, George. How you doing? You
know,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Hey to people. And it's just empty desks and empty
What year rooms. Are we talking? 80?
This is 90.
90. So the end of the 80s is there.
Yeah, literally. And so that's what happened. They cleaned house again.
Yeah.
They just, Sony took all over. I think they kept, you know, there was bands that they kept that I was like, why would they keep such a shitty band? Like, well, because they didn't spend $250,000.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, you could make that record you guys made right now for $10,000.
Know, right?
Isn't that crazy?
Exactly. So that was the thing. I think, again, the accountants come in and look at it and go, you know, we spent all this money on this band. And again, at that time, I mean, through our whole record label career, we were in every rock magazine out there constantly.
You were all the
time.
My
mom used to go to the grocery store when they had a big magazine.
Rip, Hit Parader, Circus, Bam Magazine.
My mom would keep me informed on the magazine. She'd be like, oh, you guys are in Hit Parader, Grand. Oh, you're in Rip. You're in Rock Beat, Rock Scene, all those magazines. We were all over the place. And you'd have a hard time finding a bad review on us at any level.
We had a great live show.
Our live show. It was all like, these guys have it all. But and we had it all physically, and we were signed to good record, capable record labels.
Yeah.
And still they managed to drop the ball.
What do you think it was? Bad management?
No, I think it was
just bad luck.
Just bad luck.
Right.
I think it was just bad luck. But I also think if there had been somebody of power at either Elektra or MCA,
that was a fan
that would have got it. Like we were talking about, they could have seen like, all we have to do is not drop the ball. This is all ready to go.
Yeah.
It's ready to go. It's good.
They got
to go.
The look. They got some radio songs.
Exactly.
They got a great live show.
You know, Michael Goldstone is the one who signed us to MCA.
Yeah.
He went on to do big things too.
Yeah.
But at that time, he didn't have a lot of power.
Yeah.
Because he came to MCA and got hired there, and he hadn't really done anything too big before that.
That's amazing that he got you from Elektra,
exactly.
A new guy, you know?
Yep. But for whatever reason, that was the end of that, and we were really unprepared at that point. I mean, it was literally like we would have had to come back to L.A., and all go out and get jobs. I know it sounds kind of funny to say, like, oh my God, a job. But
well,
we had been 4 years. Yeah, we had been 4 years.
I do a bit about it now. It's like, I'll be in Ralph's and I'll be like, hey, aren't you on Dokken?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Yeah, but only in the summertime. You know? So right now I'm just here working at Ralph's. And it's like, can you imagine?
Back then it was like every day and week for us was, you know, going to the clubs like Cat House. Going to famous parties at everyone, celebrity. Back then, everybody was in on our thing. I remember soap opera stars coming to our shows, movie stars, like going to parties at, you know, Dave Gahan from Depeche Mode's house, and going to parties with the Chili Peppers' house. It, just like there was always shit going on, and that's your life. And then you go to work, which is you rehearse, you write music, you get in the studio, you go play shows. Like,
your music was your job.
So for us to think about coming off the road when we were like on our way to, you know, mega stardom, and it's like, okay, the band is broke, you have no label. You know, like literally,
you're not going to pay rent.
Yeah, the management, nobody else was at that point. It was like, oh man, this is really all is lost. And so it was like, you figure it out, guys, get a job. You know, we'll keep working with you, but you got your rent's coming up and you got things coming up and whatever.
It's done.
So we did. We were like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go back to San Francisco. We can all move back in with our parents and at least have a place to stay. Then we'll regroup and we'll start to restructure. And so that's what we did, you know, which kind of sucked because we were like running home with our tail between our legs. Like, like, what just happened, you know? Yeah. And it happened so fast.
I mean, but you guys had did it, you know? There's only a few bands that left San Fran, mm-hmm. went to L.A., got the deal, put out a couple records, did videos, and in most people's minds, you made it.
Right.
Because none of us made videos.
Right.
None of us moved to L.A., you know what I mean? So you did it. It's a balls-out thing. So when you move home, the band breaks up?
The band didn't really break up. I think we kind of took a little break.
I remember you were working in a reptile store off Polk Street when I ran into you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first I was living down in the South Bay, San Jose area with my parents. And I had a little project because I was really in the punk rock skate and punk rock scene in San Jose. And so I got with some of my old bros there, Bill Franza, and we started a band called Amy the Butterfly, which was kind of like a trippy punk funk kind of band. And we had some fun with that for, you know, a year or so. We recorded some stuff. And then I think I moved back up to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And started then you working with Reptile Store.
And you started doing the metal band.
What was that? No, not at first. At first, we started recording some new music with Jet Boy, but we moved in a heavier direction.
Yeah.
Because at that time, the thing that started inspiring all us was stuff like Pantera and like, you know,
grunge.
The grunge thing wasn't really a real turn big. On, you know what I mean? Exactly. Metallica, Slayer, you know, we started kind of going backwards in a sense to some of our old metal roots. Motorhead, you know, we worked with Lemmy on some stuff, and he did some recording with us.
So you were trying to do a heavy version of Jet Boy,
an evolution,
right?
Which
is going to be weird,
exactly.
Right?
It was may have been a little too fast, and the people who were still into glam didn't want to evolve with us in that way, but we had to because, you know, there was no third deal waiting for us, and so.
The fucking the playing field had changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Know,
and for anybody out there, who's listening and is into it, we did put out a few records with Paris Records, and the material that I'm talking about of this evolution from Jet Boy from glam rock to just good heavy metal, somewhere in between Skid Row and Pantera.
Right.
You know. They're all on those Paris Records. There's like four of them.
Is that right? What are they called?
One More for Rock and Roll. I don't know. I can't remember.
But they're out there.
They're out there. Paris Records. I don't know if they're. I don't think they're in production anymore. But you can find them on eBay and whatnot.
I don't even remember that era. I just remember the next band.
Yeah. Well, then that's what we did. Ultimately, we had Bill Graham management got behind us. Ray Etzler. And eventually it was suggested, like, you know what, you guys just need to change your name because, you know, the Jet Boy name is tainted and you're trying to do something different. So that's what we did. We changed our name. A couple people fell off.
Ron
fell off. Sammy Yoffa was out. We got my buddy Bill Franza from the San Jose scheme.
And the Exodus bass player, right?
That was after Fernie left, and then Bill went from bass to guitar, and then we got Mike Butler from Exodus in. So then it was kind of like it was just me and Billy from Jet Boy.
And what was it called?
Mind Zone.
That's it. I couldn't remember.
Mind Zone. Yeah, and we did good. You know, we were like the support band for every big metal band that came to San Francisco.
Yeah, well, what happened
Biohazard
was Terminator's hit, this huge kick-ass club Terminator. Chris had going.
Yep.
And you guys played my birthday bash. Yep. I got some photos over here. Yep. I'll show you before you leave. Nice. You and I, and we did the AC/DC jam.
Yeah.
But and now San Fran had really turned into kind of this, and I coin it right around the time White Zombie 1965 hits and DNA Lounge and Terminator are gone.
Yeah.
This kind of cool scene hits in San Fran of kind of like, it's like metal, it's like Tool's hot.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
You know, White Zombie's hot. And San Fran really had a core of this feel.
Yeah, I mean, you had Machine Head came up at that time. Biohazard from New York. Yep. I remember playing with them out there. And
all that stuff was really
hitting. Head was booming.
And people were down.
Ice-T had Body Count.
Right? Remember they played the Stone?
Like,
remember?
You know, just a perfect example of how that whole, you know, grungy metal thing was hitting.
Hell yeah. Prong.
Yep, Prong.
You know, all that kind of stuff was going on.
I saw Prong last year at NAMM.
Yeah.
They did a show. And
so
I got,
cool,
I
right?
Got in. Oh,
Monty Pittman, I think he played guitar and prong. Mm-hmm. He was
Tommy Victor.
Yeah, yeah.
The man.
But that San Fran scene, to me, really felt like, besides the early San Fran scene, there's a different scenes. You got the hippies, 60s.
Yeah.
Then you've got kind of the, then to me, it never really got its name for the glam because L.A.
Right.
But you got Metallica, Exodus,
yep.
Testament,
yep.
all that.
Yeah.
And then this scene kind of hits it, and it felt like, well, this is kind of like a, you know, I-Beam, Nightbreak Sushi Sunday, the Hate Street Fairs.
Yeah.
It started to have this thing, you know, you had like Stone Fox.
Yeah.
You know, different vibes.
And it was like, you know, a lot of like dreadlock metalheads.
It was dreadlocks.
And bullet belts and stuff.
Piercings.
And then it was also the other guys, like the Machine Head guys, were all like Oakland Raiders sport gear.
Yeah.
You know, with like baseball caps with bandanas and football jerseys.
Yeah.
And like,
it was gangster
that whole thing.
Rap
totally.
Metal, you know? Like, it was crazy. But it really felt like it had something to me. I was
For sure.
And, you know, you had the Drunk Tank, like Andy Anderson's bar. And you had all this stuff in San Fran that was like, this thing's got soul.
Yeah,
and everybody was really into it.
Yeah,
and then
and the only thing is, and we were really at the peak of it.
Yeah, I mean, you guys
Machine Head was the only band that was probably playing over us. Like sometimes,
right.
If we were both on the same bill, it would be us and then Machine Head and then the headliner. But usually, we were supporting Biohazard, Motorhead. We were on bills with every great hard band that came to San Francisco. But once again, you know, we couldn't get another deal. We came really close a few times. It was also a tumultuous time in the music industry.
It was really bad.
And labels were folding left and right. So there was a couple times where we got a contract on the table and we were about ready to sign and the label would suddenly go under and things like that happened. So
it was a good band.
I'm so proud of that music.
Yeah.
If you know, a lot of the Mind Zone songs are on those Jet Boy compilations that I'm talking about. There's four of them.
Yep.
And they have a lot of songs that were right when we changed the name from Jet Boy to Mind Zone, and those songs are on there, and you'll know when you hear them
because
they sound like Metallica, Pantera, White Zombie. Like they have that style. And
it's
I'm
weird
still proud of that stuff.
You guys lived one block from me, 10th and Cabrillo.
Right, yeah,
that was the weirdest era. Like we just lived in this cool neighborhood, fucking just and you know, go up the Hate Street to Nightbreak Sushi Sunday and watch metal.
Yeah,
I really think that Chris Ostergaard and the Terminator nightclub, the original one that was down there in the Mission.
Hell yeah, that was.
That
badass
was an
club.
Iconic time in San Fran.
For
it
sure.
felt like we finally have our fucking...
I mean, that place was packing, what, like 700, 800, 1,000 people every week?
Every weekend.
Every week.
For no reason.
And downstairs.
It was just
like,
that British guy, Matt, DJ, and fucking like White Zombie.
Yeah, and a small downstairs room, you know?
Yeah, and it was just wild, you know? And bikers
I want to say it was kind of the equivalent of the first Scream, the downtown Scream.
It really felt
like
that, right?
Downstairs room and the upstairs room. And
I felt pretty proud, too. I was like, San Fran, real. Even though the Stone was huge and iconic.
Yeah, right.
That was huge and iconic. It never... You never went like, you know, Whiskey A Go Go, the Roxy, CBGB, and the Stone. That never came.
Yeah.
But with Terminator, it was like, this is fucking ours, man. This is fucking metal.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
It was funny because it was so anti Slims and Boss Gags Club. Everybody's up there. It's like, nah, this is down in the fucking dungeon.
Yep. For sure, man.
Shit, man. So, you're going to move to Hawaii, right?
Yeah, I was over there for about 6-7 years. I moved over there after my first divorce.
What made you move there?
My first divorce.
Yeah, like Hawaii, though. I mean, you go there, and that's a hard move.
Yeah, I had a friend that I worked with at a pet store in San Francisco, out at Animal Connection. We worked in the reptile department together. He was from there. He moved back there. So I had kept in contact with him. And when I needed a fresh start, after Mind Zone, when I kind of left the music business for a while, my ex-wife and I moved to San Diego.
Yeah.
And I kind of fell in love with the beach world and just surfing, and you know, I've always been into fishing and nature and stuff. So
where were you at, like PB or something?
I was in Linda Vista, you know, but yeah, I used to hang out in PB and MB and
you were doing surfing and shit?
Yeah, totally. Out at Scripps and Black's Beach and you know world class waves down there.
And where were you working? A reptile place?
No, I actually was apprenticing to Body Pierce. So I was working at a piercing studio. And yeah, that,
and know, that's good money down there. Everybody's got fucking holes in their head, right?
Yeah, right.
It's hilarious.
And then the marriage went sour after 3 years, and I needed a fresh start somewhere. And I had gone on a couple trips to Hawaii, and you know, it's Hawaii, you know. Yeah. So I was like,
which island?
I'm out of here. I went to Maui first.
Yep.
Lived there for about a year.
How'd you like it?
I loved it, man. I loved it.
You get island fever there, right? It's small. What is it, 17 miles or something?
Nah, you don't get island fever. I didn't get island fever. If you move there, then you got to be into island shit.
Yeah.
If you're not into surfing and fishing and kayaking and hiking and nature, then don't fucking go there.
Kirk Hammock has a place there and surfs.
But if you're into that shit, you know, I mean, really into it. So like, I will never get sick of fishing and doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So if you're into that kind of stuff, then it's a beautiful lifestyle. Maui is definitely a little bit, you know, more old school Hawaii.
Right.
Hawaii is like fully old school Hawaii. But Oahu is like a little mini LA on a Hawaiian island. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Very modern.
You got drugs, you got rock, you got comedy. Yep.
You got a good tourist downtown underground scene. There's raves over there. There's, you know, not so much rock and metal shows, but they're there. You know what I mean? But at this point in my life, you know, I'm older. I just got married again.
How old are you?
God bless my wife, Angelique. I'm 50 years old.
50?
Yeah, 50 years old.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm 50. Thank God, after all the abuse I've done to my
body. We're alive.
I'm alive, and I still look pretty good.
Yeah.
But on the inside, I know that, you know, I am 50, and I've always wanted to have a kid. It didn't work out for me yet, so I just got married a year and a half ago. Shout out to my wife, Angelique. And we want to have a kid, and we want to be somewhere, you know, beautiful.
You got jobs when you get there?
I have a job right now. I work for the world's best pomade company, Layrite.
Yeah.
Out of Southern California, 14 years strong, down in Costa Mesa, Layrite. You know, most of my work has been sales related, so
yep.
I do sales for them. I work from home, which is a beautiful thing, and I can do it from anywhere.
Yeah.
So
how do you, how'd you get with Layrite?
You know what? I approached them at Viva Las Vegas. I mean, for those of you that don't know, I've been really into the rockabilly and psychobilly scene for quite a while.
Playing with our good boy, Danny.
Playing with Danny Dangerous of the Purple Haired Zeros. And we have a band called Cold Blue Rebels, so we have a whole theatrical zombie rock thing we do. We dress like you do? Yeah, we dress like greaser zombies
from the 50s.
And we've got zombie go-go dancers, and we put on a good show. And it's
impossible to fuck a rockabilly chick if you're just outside the scene, right?
Oh, the real rockabilly chicks? Yeah, they don't even want punk rock guys. They want guys that really, like...
You gotta have rotary dial phone, right?
That's why I like psychobilly a little better, because it's a blending of punk rock and rockabilly. But Cold Blue Rebels. We've had 5 videos. We did 5, you know, pretty cool videos.
Hey, you just got off. You went on a tour, right?
Yeah, we just did 6 weeks with Wednesday 13. That was our third tour with Wednesday 13 from Murder Dolls, and you know, it's just like.
Are you going to play once you go to Hawaii? You're like, what?
Yeah, we're going to keep it alive.
Yeah.
We are playing Viva Las Vegas this year, which we do every year.
Yep.
At Diablo's, which is right on the strip in front of the Monte Carlo.
When is
that? It's on the 18th of April.
Oh, dope.
Friday night, playing with the Adolescents.
Yeah.
And at Viva 1 year, I had approached Mike,
Layrite.
One of the owners at Layrite, and told him that I used the product and... You know, I was just kind of fishing for like, hey, could I maybe, you know, hook some stuff up?
Yeah. I'm thinking that right now myself. Like, hey, can you just send me some cans?
And I think he, you know, I made an impression and he remembered me. And then I also used to work for Lip Service Clothing, my old buddy Drew Bernstein.
Was the rock and roll clothing of glam rock. Yep.
Lip Service. So I was a sales rep there for about 4 years. And when I left that job, I think Mike caught wind of it through my barber, Jimmy the Barber, down at Hollywood's.
Yeah.
You know, he told Mike, you know, I think they were looking for good people to bring into Layrite. So, you know, they brought me in as an affiliate, which is really like, wasn't officially working for them, but I had the ability to open accounts here and there when I was on the road, if I found a cool barbershop or whatever.
Yeah.
And then just this year they restructured the company and they wanted to bring in, you know, full-time people. So,
Benefits?
Health benefits.
Wow.
A whole bit, man.
And that's gold when you're 50, right?
Yep, exactly. So you know, I told them when they hired me full time that I was like, you know, my wife and I are probably going to go back to Hawaii because her family is all there. We don't right. have any family in L.A.
Yeah,
my parents are up.
And you want to have a kid? You need some babysitters.
Yeah, we want to have a kid. We want to like you know just I don't want to raise my kid in L.A. No offense, L.A. But
yeah,
yeah L.A. Yeah. can chew you up and spit you out hard.
Hell
you
know yeah. what I mean?
And I think we both are kind of done with it. We've been here for 7 years now and just grinding, you know what I mean? Touring, playing, recording, just yeah. in the scene everywhere. And we're kind of ready to settle down a little bit. Music is in my blood. I know that. So when I lived in Hawaii before, I was a pretty big DJ. I was promoting my own club nights.
Wow.
Shout out to Subphonics, my crew over there.
That's great.
We had the biggest drum and bass night in Hawaii for about 5 years running. And then I started producing electronic music, and so it's going to be in me. Who knows what I'll be getting.
It's just our journey,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. I'll be involved with music at some level forever.
You know what I love? Is I'm on stage Thursday night at the Comedy Store.
Mm-hmm.
I come off, and as I walk by, you go, yo, man, it's Mickey. I love when I
yeah,
see guys,
I know, totally.
And we're still alive,
yep, yep.
and we've been fucking friends since 1983, dude.
I was telling my wife today.
1983, yeah. So when I see a guy like that, I go, fuck yeah, yeah. man.
Like I tell my wife, we've been friends longer than you've been alive.
Yeah, isn't that weird? And I'm just like, I love when I see dudes like
yeah,
that.
Totally.
I immediately want to yep. grab them like, yeah, yeah. dude, we're yep. here, you know?
And it happens, like, that's what I love about going on the road, too.
Yeah.
Because people come out of the woodwork and stuff and you're just like, oh my god, I didn't even remember you existed. I might have never thought of you again for the rest of my life.
That's how it is.
You pop up and it's like, oh, it's all coming back now.
Out of sight, out of mind, right? It's a trip, man. But you know, it's so great that you were down there and I got to get you on the show before
yeah.
you split
oh,
the
yeah.
wire.
You, by the way, were so great that night.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, it was cool because I had never been in the original front room there.
Yeah, the original room.
And I didn't know you were playing.
Yeah.
It just so happened Angelique, my wife's sister, came from Hawaii for a few days.
Yep.
For a quick visit. And, you know, we wanted to bring her out somewhere. And, you know, Danny works there. So he hooked up, you know, free tickets for us. And I didn't know the lineup at all, but
yeah.
I knew it was going to be good, you yep. know? And then you came out, and I was like, oh, my God, you're kidding me. And because, you know, I hadn't seen your comedy.
Yeah, you never seen me, yeah.
I had not seen your comedy. You've always been funny. My yeah. wife asked me that today, too. She said, has he always been funny? And I'm like, yeah, he's always been funny.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Definitely, if I was going to describe Dean, that guy's a fucking riot, always funny.
Yeah.
Always loud and funny and, you know,
yeah,
animated. You
definitely
know?
Loud.
And seeing you now after you've got a few years of comedy under your belt where I'm like, you know, he's got his shit together and he's got great delivery and his material's great. And,
yeah.
you know, I think you and Sebastian were like my favorite too that night.
Oh, that's great.
We had seen him once before. And
he's amazing,
he's
right?
He's funny. He's just funny before he even says anything.
Oh, yeah.
He just comes out and walks back and forth a couple times and you're already laughing.
What
you kind of have that too.
What
you
I
just
like
have
about
this aura of
I,
like, you know.
What I like about Sebastian is we're older dudes mm-hmm. and I know he's going to get funnier as he gets older because he's kind of like not in the racist way of Gran Torino,
right.
Clint Eastwood, like, get the fuck out my lawn.
Right.
But he really has this great voice of like, look at these fucking yeah, assholes.
Totally.
You know what I mean? And I love yeah. that. He's yeah. just going to have gallons of material. He's definitely a big inspiration to me. But it's so the freedom for me to go on from mm-hmm. playing music 25 mm-hmm. years and then doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You can relate to this too if you're a DJ. Mm-hmm. It's you.
Yeah, exactly. It's just an extension of yourself.
As much as you loved your brothers when you were younger, you think back of like, probably had a couple wrong pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And I always felt like that. Like, I always had such a passion. The way I do comedy is the way I did rock and roll.
Right.
We're fucking one for all, mm-hmm. all for one, full steam ahead.
Yep. And you got to have it all.
You got to have it all.
You got to have the delivery. You got to have the material.
Yeah.
You got to have the timing. Like,
it's everything, you know,
it
man.
Is.
And,
yep.
and people don't know who the fuck I am. Most of the guys on the lineup you saw are on TV and movies.
Right.
So when I come up, they're like, what the fuck is this? This guy's got to be like the intermission.
Right. Yeah.
Whatever. And then I've got to hit them right away.
Yep.
And then they go, oh, all
you
right.
Do.
Yeah.
You smack them right in the face,
man. That's how you got to do it, man. So it was
well,
great.
I'm sure you're on your way to being in TV and movies and stuff, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the thing with me is I've already made it.
Yeah, right.
Because I love doing what I do. Mm-hmm, so I don't give a fuck. Whatever I get on top of this is just cream.
Right.
Because to go on every night in that comedy store,
yeah,
I've made it. My name's on that wall. Yeah. And I don't need anything else, man. Yeah. I just need to kill people with these jokes.
Well, that's the best attitude. And that's probably when things are going to happen for you, because you're not desperately trying to make it happen. You know?
I'm happier than ever, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? And now I really love rock and roll again from the outside.
Right, right.
Once you step out of the industry and everything, you go like, I've been buying all my favorite records one at a time, mint condition. Right. I put it on and I just go, fuck. Yeah,
totally. I've been listening to a lot of classic rock again too, or a lot of rock from my youth, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, like when you put it on, it reminds you of the days of, it's that, there's something about that vinyl, you put it on, you sit down, it reminds me of just beers, drinking on a Friday night at some guy's keg party.
Yep.
Hey, turn it on side two, man.
Yeah, totally.
Put on fucking Looks to Kill.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whatever. That, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
That's the original excitement of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Buying that record.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming down, dude. Where can they find you?
Well,
Facebook, Twitter, what do you got?
I'm on Facebook, Mickey Finn.
Yeah.
And also you can check out our band Cold Blue Rebels on YouTube and on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram, Mickey Laywright.
Oh yeah. Oh, is good. My Instagram. I'm going to follow so you right away.
Yeah, follow me there.
And, let's get some Layright over at this house here.
Oh, yeah. No, you got Layright coming your way, man. shout out to all my crew over there at Layright. It's the best hair product in the world. Anyone that knows me and remembers Jet Boys, don't mess with my hair. You know, I'm a
serious
hair man.
It smells great.
It smells great. It's,
it washes out. It
washes out clean. And it's the best water-soluble pomade on the planet. It can put up a mohawk and hold it up all night. A pompadour, comb over, side parts, you name it.
For all you...
And get your haircut down at Hollywood's in Long Beach or Costa Mesa, the original Donnie Hawley.
Is that Hollywood. Right? Hollywood's in Long Beach?
I'm down there. H-A-W-E-L, Hawley, Hollywood's.
H-A-W-E-L?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
His name's Donnie Hawley. He's
I'm always down there.
Barber, and
the
he developed the Layright product.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
I'm going to go in there and get my haircut.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, man. There he is right there. Mickey Finn, check out Jet Boy on YouTube.
Yeah.
I watched Evil today. I hadn't seen it in 10 years. Yeah. It was great. Brought me back.
We just played the Whiskey, too, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, fuck, I'm so bummed.
So there's some live videos from the Whiskey show also.
I wanted to go
also.
To that so bad. And I was out of town, I think like San Fran that night, because it was during the NAMM show. Mm-hmm. And I was pissed, man. It was a Saturday night.
Yeah, we played with Faster Pussycat, so it was a good old school day. Hanging with Ricky Rockman, of course, was there.
Yeah, I had both those
Tammy
guys on the show.
Tammy and all those guys,
Tammy, last thing, you ride now, right?
Yeah, we're going to ride for sure, dude.
Oh, yeah, we got to ride before you move. What do you ride?
I have a Sportster 48.
That's
Sportster
a great
48.
Bike.
I did the pipes, got Vanzenheim pipes. I did the heavy breather air intake.
Yeah.
I did the power command, so my fuel mixture's right.
Yeah, yeah.
I put some nice mini hangers on there.
That's a great bike. What color did you get?
I got the black with orange gas tank because my birthday's Halloween.
Yeah.
They call me the Pumpkin King. I got it tattooed on my
knuckles. I love the orange sparkle.
So, yeah, it's all blacked out with the
orange sparkle tank.
It's not. It's just a plain Harley or orange.
Got you. They have some sparkle ones
they do.
Now, like the green and the gold. A buddy of mine rented one. I taught him to ride. And so I picked it up at Glendale and rode it over to his house. I was like, this is a great fucking bike.
It is. It's got the fat front tire.
It's like Exile.
I think it's the nicest looking Sportster they've ever done.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, it comes set up pretty good.
It comes set up great.
You want to do a few things, you know.
Got forward controls on it or mids?
Forward controls.
Yeah. I like mids because I'm short.
Yep.
But God, that's a great bike. Yeah, we're riding for sure.
I got that one down in Orange County, Harley. Shout out to those guys down there. And then
LA Harley? LA,
no, I got it down in Orange County, Harley. I've had my bike worked on LA and also in Glendale.
Yeah, yeah. LA Harley sponsors my podcast.
Yeah,
Yeah, they're fantastic, man. The thing I like about LA Harley is they were old school over there in Paramount or whatever, and then they combined over there. But I like some of their mechanics. There's this guy, Ron. He's been there like 30 years.
Yeah, nice.
I go in, I bring my bike. I want a guy that's been working on bikes 30 years.
You know, I'll give a shout out, too. There's a real good shop in Burbank called Born Free Cycles.
Oh, yeah. And well, I love Born Free.
Those guys do great work over there.
Yep.
Super solid team. And if you want to have a custom bike build, those guys are really, really good too.
Harley's the best, right?
You know it, man.
I didn't ride
my Harley shirt on right now.
I didn't ride Harley for 5 years because I rode them all my life, and I was like, ah, I got to get off this.
Yeah, this is my first Harley. I used to ride sport bikes.
You know,
I had a GPZ 750. I had all raced out, and I rode dirt bikes back in the day. I used to race motocross and stuff.
Yeah. Great
I'm
shit.
I'm a biker down to the soul, man.
Are you taking your bike to Hawaii?
Oh, hell yeah.
How do you do it?
Shipping it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you got to get it crated, and then it'll be shipped. I'm shipping my car. I'm shipping my bike.
And when are you leaving?
June 1st.
Fuck, going to miss you, 1st. Dude. Yeah. We're riding before you leave. Let's ride.
Spring's coming, man.
Yeah, let's do it. We're riding. Well, after today, after the rain, it'll be fine to ride for the next 10 years.
I know, right?
There he is, man. Yeah. Rock and roll, bikes. Lay right, that's fucking it. Metal, reptiles, we covered it all.
Yes.
Mickey Finn, thanks guys for tuning in. Long live San Francisco. See you guys.
Yeah.